Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Yes, it is. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Law Talk. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. This is our Saturday afternoon legal toolbox, sort of our legal get-together here in very, very unsettled times in a lot of ways. I left the house about a half hour ago. It's bright sun. Got here about 15 minutes ago, snowing heavily. Now we're on the air and the sun is back out. So a lot of unsettled things out there. And there's a lot of things in the law that change pretty regularly also. One of my jobs is to let you know about some of those. And we're going to be doing that today right up until 4 o'clock. But more importantly, we take your phone calls regarding your legal problems, your legal issues, your legal comments, and we discuss them on the air, because doing so allows us not only to try and help you, but to help others that may be interested in a similar type of issue. So how do you reach us? You reach us by phoning us at 860-522-WTIC. 1-800-966-WTIC, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. And if your device, it's easier with numbers than letters, that's 860-522-9842 and 1-800-966-9842. If you're thinking about giving us a call, we'd love to hear from you. It's better for all if you call us earlier rather than later in the program. That way, we can give you more time than if you call towards the end, because once 4 o'clock rolls around, it's time for Dave Mager, News, Sports, Weather. And then it's Jill on Money, syndicated financial talk show from New York. Just a delightful lady and very, very good information. So that's the lineup for the next couple of hours here. Right now, though, we are live and delighted to help you out with phone calls at 860-522-9842, 1-800-966-WTIC. So let me give you an idea of some of the things we're going to be covering today, okay? We got a request from Tom at the bank for 2 minutes on trusts. We're going to talk about a twist in the law regarding boats, and that is triggered by an email from a landlubber who happens to have had a former tenant at a rental property of his who stored boats on the rental property. Something that boaters need to know about, something that landlords need to know about, and in fact, it has a broader application also. It's a relatively new law. It's pretty much untested in the courts, although there was one recent decision, and we're going to be discussing that more detail going forward. And in addition, we're going to be talking about something called the sudden emergency doctrine. Imagine this. You're driving down the highway, and something happens unexpectedly. You lose control of your car, and you rear-end the car in front of you, causing damage and injuries to the driver and the occupants. Well, this sudden emergency doctrine, is that going to save you and get you off the hook for money damages that would otherwise be due the persons that you injured? Well, it was tried recently, and we'll tell you what the court said about it and why. So we're going to be doing these and anything else that you bring up to our attention. And we do that right here from 3 until 4 these Saturday afternoons. We do it as a public service. So we're delighted to hear from you and to help you out with this. Let's start off with an email from a guy named Tom. This is Tom at the bank. He said, hey, can you do 2 minutes on trusts? So the email is remarkable for its brevity. It's remarkable for the assumption that anyone thinks a lawyer can talk for only 2 minutes about anything. But Tom, I appreciate it. And so let's try to do a streamlined Cliff Notes version of this topic so that people at least have a structural framework in which to discuss it, okay? The topic itself goes far beyond what we could fit into 2 minutes or even into 2 hours. There are courses in law school that take a whole year dealing with the various aspects of all of this. So this is how we're going to do it. And while it may not be 2 minutes, we'll try to keep it compact, okay? First of all, you got to think of a trust as maybe a basket or a place to hold stuff. Now, we got two kinds of them here, okay? On your left hand, you got a basket that we're going to call a living trust. Back when I was in law school and Latin was still permitted, it was called an inter vivos trust. Inter vivos meaning between the living. So, okay, left hand, you're holding a basket that says living trust. Right hand, you got a basket that says testamentary trust. Okay, what's that mean? Well, that's a phrase that describes a trust that was created in a person's will. Okay, the trust is nothing other than words on paper until that person dies, until their will is presented to the probate court, and until it is admitted to probate as the last will and testament of that person. The testamentary trust is a part of the document that springs into existence at that point, and the will explains a lot more about how it's actually going to work out. Okay, so let's take a fast look at the basket in your left hand, the living trust, the so-called inter vivos trust. Okay, now it's got two parts to it. This basket has two little parts. Maybe there's a divider in the middle. Now, one side, you have what's called a revocable trust, or if you prefer, revocable trust, all the same. And this is far and away the most common type of inter vivos trust that we see, okay? If you end up going to one of those foolish seminars where in return for coffee and dessert, they're going to sell you some pre-printed trusts for $3,600 or something like that, it's likely that you're going to end up with a revocable trust. But more about that later. Now, the other half of that basket in your left hand is what's called an irrevocable trust. And that's a smaller part of the basket that's occupied. And the reason for that is because it's less common. Okay? A revocable trust is tax neutral. An irrevocable trust is a whole different situation. Okay? A revocable trust is a trust into which you place assets, but because it's revocable, you can take them out and put them back in your own name also. So therefore, under the tax laws, there's no tax savings by taking assets from your own name and sticking them into a revocable trust. In fact, when you die, what's going to happen is that the assets in your revocable trust are going to be considered for tax calculation purposes as part of the estate that was in your own name. So it doesn't make any difference tax-wise. One advantage of a revocable trust is that there's some privacy, and the trustee manages the trust and is not initially subject to probate court supervision. However, there are some ways around that, and there are ways that others who are interested in the matter, legally interested, can invoke certain statutes and get the probate court involved in the matter. So that's revocable. Irrevocable trusts, they have their own separate identity, their own separate tax-paying obligations. They can sue and be sued, all kinds of things like that. Okay? These are not tax neutral. And people that do estate planning often have to consider the difference in the tax rate for income or capital gains or things of that sort generated within an irrevocable trust versus what the tax consequences would be if those same assets had stayed in the settlor's name, the person being the creator of that trust. So that's the difference between the two primary flavors of inter vivos or living trusts. We're going to talk a little bit more about testamentary trusts, but it's time for us to take a break. We're delighted to hear from you at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. We've got a bunch of different topics. It's wide open listener selection. Kathy in Middletown, we're going to get to you right after this. We are Michael mellowing us back into the next segment of Law Talk. I'm Attorney John Matulis, delighted to have you with us this Saturday afternoon. Just wanted to let you know that you can reach us at 860-522-WTIC with your legal questions, comments, issues, problems. Try to give you a hand. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S., 1-800-966-9842. We periodically get questions. Well, what about email? Yes, you can do that also. My email address, it's john.matulis, that's my last name, M-A-T-U-L-I-S, at entercom.com. That's john.matulis at entercom.com. We probably will not get to your email on the air, but we'll take it up at a later show. And by sending it to us, you're agreeing that it's okay to do that. If you want us not to use your first name, just let us know, and that's okay with us. In the meantime, let's go to the phones. Kathy in Middletown, thanks for holding, and you're on Law Talk.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us how we can help you.
Well, we recently converted our house from oil to gas.
Uh-huh.
And during the conversion, let me preface this. It's in the basement. I have a in-law apartment in the basement. I just replaced the floors with LifeLock, whatever that laminated stuff is.
Yeah, understood.
So we did the hall downstairs. So the conversion guys came in, and as they were doing the work, they took the oil tank out and gouged up through the kitchen some of the flooring, which was approximately 3 weeks old.
Uh-oh.
We're not happy. They also gouged, some like ladder marks over in another area. The whole square footage is probably like around 800 square feet, and the scratches are nowhere near each other. So we asked the guy that had laid the floor and stuff to come over and give me an estimate. And he gave me an estimate, which came to approximately $2,300, because he says you have to replace all the boarding because the integrity will be compromised.
Okay.
The owner and the manager came over, and they had looked at the floors, and I had sent them pictures, and then I didn't hear from them. So I called them and sent them the estimate, and they're like, that's way too much money. We'll give you $500. What are my options?
Okay, you have a couple of options here. One option is to sue them in small claims court for the full amount of the estimate that you received from the flooring contractor, the $2,300, and that'll force the issue. Some third party, some magistrate, will decide exactly what the damage was worth. Now, the fact they think it's too much is pretty much irrelevant. They're going to have to come up with something more than just, we think that's too much. If they say we want to get our own contractor to give us an estimate, you have to do that. If they come up with an estimate that says, well, it's $1,500, we'll pay $1,500, then the decisions
right.
get tougher, because now you got to decide whether you want to hold out the higher number. But for somebody who damaged it to come back and say, oh, it's too much, we're not going to pay that, just doesn't get you home. So what I would suggest is that you think about a lawsuit in small claims court for this. There are some other things you can do also. These days, many contractors have websites, and there are often reviews or comments. Some of them are very, very sensitive to negative comments. And what you might want to do is say that your figure of $500 that you apparently pulled out of of thin air is grossly inadequate and there's no basis for it. So unless you pay the $2,300 in our estimate, within 10 days, we are going to file a suit in small claims court. So I think that that's, and at that point, if you have to file the suit, then I think that putting some kind of a negative review out there in social media is not inappropriate either. And some okay. contractors are very, very sensitive to that. Others, not so much. Are you familiar with the small
like
claims
really
court?
This seems like a really reputable company, and I would think they would be upset. I'm shocked.
Yeah, the flooring that you put down, it sounds like this was pre-finished material. You described it, and so it's not material that can just be sanded and refinished. It has to be taken up and replaced. Well, maybe these guys don't realize that, or maybe they're just trying to save money, but the damage that they potentially suffer in terms of reputation is going to be a lot more than the difference between what you want and what they offered, because people like that that are allowed to come into your home to do work and end up damaging it and not paying for it, not good for business.
Yeah, and on another level, they were a couple of their guys were actually drinking sodas out of the refrigerator.
Oh, my goodness. You're kidding.
Yeah. No. I told the guy, the manager, I spoke with him, and I said, I don't want the guy fired, but I want you to know they're grabbing root beers out of the fridge. So just an FYI. But, I'm not, I don't want to be I'm trying to get along.
Kathy, you did all the right things. First of all, you identified the damage. You had a contractor come in and give you what I assume is a written estimate for the cost of the repair that is necessary because of what they did. And at this point, you presented it to them, and I don't see how any reputable contractor can complain that they've been mistreated. And if they want to say it's too much, we'll offer you $500. Well, too bad. Are you familiar with the small claims process? Because it's very layperson friendly. You can, many people do this themselves. Although you are entitled to hire an attorney if you wish.
I wasn't sure if I needed an attorney or should I like pay another person to come in and write me another estimate, kind of like getting your car fixed. I don't know.
It never hurts to have more than one estimate, but if all they've got is it's too much, we'll give you $500, an estimate from a reputable contractor who's very familiar with that particular job is going to be a lot more credible than what they've offered so far. Once you sue them, they might go and get some kind of an estimate. And at that point, maybe a second estimate is a good idea for you to have, so it'll show that the number that you have is in the exact right ballpark. But the small claims court is very user-friendly. Now, you're in Middletown. Okay. I'm pretty sure that there's a court service center at the courthouse there on Court Street in Middletown. I think it's on the first floor. And there's a lot of material that is intended to help people use the small claims court without having to hire an attorney. They're frequently asked questions. They have the necessary forms. There's probably something that lays out the procedure. So if you feel like giving it a shot, I think you can do so. And of course, you always can hire an attorney if you wish. That's up to you. They are not prohibited in small claims court, but the rules are specifically written so that for matters like this, where the value involved is less than $5,000, people should be able to handle it without having to go to the expense of hiring an attorney.
Okay.
And I wish you the best with it. And please give us a call on a future show and let us know how it turns out, okay?
Absolutely. I will. Thank you for your time. I truly appreciate it.
Well, best of luck with it, Kathy. Thanks for calling. Okay. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, our phone number is 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. We were talking a little bit before about this topic that Tom at the bank wanted 2 minutes on trusts. Well, we've run over the 2 minutes so far, but we didn't quite explain all about the other part of it. So we're going to take just a minute until we have to break. Testamentary trusts, okay? We mentioned they're created by the will. They don't spring into existence until the will is admitted to probate. The trustee is supervised by the probate court. And so that's something different. A big advantage, though, is that it allows the person the testator or testatrix, the person who signed the will, to retain possession and use of all of the property right up until the time of their death. So that is important. And of course, once the person dies and the will is admitted to probate, the trust is obviously revocable at that point. One thing to remember is that not only is that testamentary trust revocable before then, but so is the will, which creates it. So just remember, a lot of people don't understand, once you've done a will, it's not set in concrete. You can change that later on, and some people change it a number of different times. If your feelings about people that are named in the will change, if the nature of your assets changes, see the lawyer that drafted up the will for you, and they'll be happy to make the necessary adjustments. We're going to have to break in a minute for Dave Mager and news, sports, and weather. Law Talk is going to be with you right up until 4 o'clock today. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. There you have it, the Bobby Fuller Four, bumping us back into the second half hour of Law Talk on a formerly snowy Saturday, he alliterated, here in Hartford. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We are here until 4 o'clock today. We're taking phone calls, comments, legal issues. You reach us at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC. All that ends with 9842. Dan and Hebron, stick with us. We're going to be with you in just a moment. In the meantime, we're here only until 4. Better to call a little bit earlier than later. Guarantees us more time to be able to help out you with your question. This is the time of the show where I'm expected to tell you that if you do not have an attorney and you're looking for some legal information or even some representation, the Hartford County Bar Association sponsors a not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Now, this is better than billboard ads, better than internet ads. If you still have a phone directory, better than ads in there. This is how it works. You phone them at the phone number that I'm going to give you in just a moment. They'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the nature of your legal inquiry, and they will then refer you to an experienced attorney who is insured, who is free of disciplinary entanglements, and who practices in the proper discipline to help you with your legal issue. So what do you get and what does it cost? Well, what you get is a half-hour consult with that attorney. And after the end of the half hour, there's no further obligation whatsoever. There's no hard sell for further services. And on top of that, you do this conference either over the telephone with the attorney or in the attorney's office. That's up to the two of you. What does it cost, you wondered? Well, there's a one-time only $35 fee to help underwrite some of the administrative expenses for running the program. But if you're calling about your personal injury claim, they will waive the $35 fee. If you are calling about your Social Security disability claim, ditto, no $35 fee. What about my workers' comp claim, someone asked? Same thing, they will waive the fee. Here's how you reach them. It's the Hartford County Bar Association Not-for-Profit Lawyer Referral Service at 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. I know that many of you are listening to us on the internet, and you may think that somebody in Hartford County can't help me out. Well, that may be true, especially if you're in a different state, but give them a call because there are other similar programs. These are all built on a model from the American Bar Association, and they may be able to steer you to a similar program in your neck of the woods. So that is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. Enough said. Let's go to the listeners. Dan and Hebron, thanks for your patience, and you're on Law Talk.
Hi, I have a question about actually a lawyer who, he was a patent attorney who failed to notify me of action.
Uh-huh.
So much time has passed. Is that something I could take that lawyer's claims court?
You broke up just a little bit there at the end, Dan. So if you could just give us that last thought again, then I can respond.
So the Patent and Trademark Office responded with an action, I guess is what they call it. And this attorney dropped the ball. He never notified us.
Okay.
And now he's claiming that I'm kind of out of luck.
Well.
And I'm fairly invested in the process. I mean, you know.
Oh, I can imagine. This is an area which, even though it's a specialty, is still governed by the same principles of legal malpractice. And whether it's medical malpractice, attorney malpractice, accountant malpractice, these are the things that you have to show. Number one, you have to show what the reasonably prudent attorney in the exact same circumstances should have done, okay, or not done. The second thing is you have to show that this particular attorney either didn't do what the reasonably prudent attorney would have done, or that this attorney did something that the reasonably prudent attorney in the same circumstances would not have done. And the next thing you have to show is that as a result of that action or omission, it's called a departure from the standard of care, okay? Third thing you have to show is that as a result of that, that you suffered damages. So those are the four elements. Number one, what would the reasonable attorney have done? Number two, how did this person depart from the standard of care? Number three, the departure was a material factor in the damages you suffered. And number four, here are the damages that we've suffered. So that's the outline of any professional malpractice case. Now, in this case here, and in most cases, whether or not another attorney will take the case is driven in large measure by how well you can quantify your damages and how difficult it may be to prove them. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about the claim and see if we can address that further, or does this outline basically help you out with analyzing how you proceed here?
Well, the value of it would be about $2,000, so I was thinking small claims court, but it would be a challenge to take on an attorney by myself.
If the value of the damages is $2,000, you're going to have great difficulty getting an attorney who's going to do it on a contingent fee basis, okay?
Yeah.
As you might know, and some of our listeners may not know, that's where the attorney agrees that for his or her entire compensation, they'll take an agreed-upon percentage of what you recover. But at $2,000, the typical percentage would be one-third. That means their absolute upside potential is, what, $660? For a lot of attorneys, that's 2 hours of billable time, or maybe a little bit more or a little bit less. So I think it'd be very difficult for you to interest an attorney in representing you on a contingent fee basis. On a per hour basis, you may run up a legal bill which exceeds the amount at stake. What you can try to do, if you would like, you know, you can sue in small claims court. As I'd mentioned to the woman who called from Middletown previously, there are a lot of ways that a person can learn how to do this, and it is specifically intended to be a court that's friendly to lay people. So if you go to the judicial, this is here in Connecticut, correct?
Sure. Yes,
okay.
It is.
So you can go to the judicial branch website, and that's www.jud.ct.gov. And on that website is a lot of information, frequently asked questions, how to represent yourself in small claims court, etc. So you should probably think about giving that a try. But then again, if this is a matter that's truly important to you and the cost-benefit analysis is more secondary, you may want to engage an attorney to assist you with this. Now, let me give you one very valuable piece of information. If you choose to sue this attorney in small claims court, the attorneys or the defendants sometimes move to transfer the matter to the superior court. That is their privilege as long as they do it in timely fashion and pay the fee. So why am I mentioning this to you? Not to intimidate you, to let you know that once the defendant has done that, if you go back and hire an attorney, because now you're in the superior court where the rules are a lot more complex, some people would say they're a lot more abstruse, and you prevail, they're going to have to pay you your attorney's fees also. So the law contains a built-in detriment or a disincentive for defendants transferring the case from the small claims court where they've been sued to the superior court where you really need to have a much better grasp of some complex rules and have to hire an attorney. So I just pass that along, Dan, because if you do sue in small claims court and if this attorney or his insurance company's attorneys transfer to the superior court, go check the private bar. I think you're going to find somebody that may be willing to help you out as long as the case has merit, because if you prevail, they're going to get their attorney's fees paid, and this isn't going to be some percentage of what you got. It's going to be the reasonable value of their fees as determined by the judge.
That's helpful. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Dan, if you do it, let us know on a future show how it turns out, okay?
All righty.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, thanks for calling. Good luck with that. Okay, well, another point for all of you that may be interested in small claims court. If you sue somebody in small claims court and they hire an attorney and transfers it to the superior court because of the fact that it's a much more complicated forum and so on, first of all, they have the right to do that. They can get a jury trial in the superior court. They cannot get one in the small claims court. So as long as they do it in timely fashion and pay the fee, they can do that. But I cannot stress enough, if you're the poor plaintiff on the other end of that, go and talk to a lawyer, because the law provides that if you continue in the superior court with an attorney and you prevail, not only are you going to get your damages, but you're going to get your attorney's fees. The amount is discretionary with the judge, but your attorney will keep good time records. And even if the attorney's fees are several multiples of the amount of damages, the court is likely to award them. I see that we're going to have to take a break here, and so we'll be back after this. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. What you're listening to is Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. Okay, here we are back at WTIC and WTIC.com. I'm Attorney John Matulis, and this is Law Talk. I've got an email from Mike in Meriden that I want to share with you. Mike writes, "Hey, last week you said you had new info for people dealing with someone else's boat on their property. I didn't hear anything on the air, and I didn't hear anything on the podcast either. What gives? My former tenant left a boat behind when he took off with his girlfriend. I want to sell it and apply the money that I get to what he owes me. Can't I do that?" Okay, well, first of all, Mike, thank you very much for the email. If any of you'd like to email me, it's john.matulis@entercom.com. That's my last name, john.matulis@entercom.com. Now, what Mike is talking about is the program last week where we'd said we were going to talk about a relatively new law that plays out this way, especially in light of the fact the weather is getting so much better and people are thinking about stuff like boating. Here we are in southern New England. We've got lakes, we've got rivers, we've got streams and ponds, we've got Long Island Sound, and it's a big industry. But listener calls take priority, and even though we had that piece all set to go, we had a lot of listener calls, and that's why we did those instead. Mike also made mention of the fact he had listened to the podcast and didn't hear anything about it. You should know that all of these programs are recorded, and usually by Monday close of business, they're up on the radio station website as a podcast. So in case you didn't know that, but you want to catch one of these or you want to let somebody else know about it, here's what you do. It's WTIC.com. And then across the top, there's a bar there, and click onto Heard on WTIC. And when you do that, you're going to get what's called daily schedule. And if you go all the way through that to the end, you'll find the Saturday stuff. And if the 3 to 4 o'clock is Law Talk, click on that. And you'll find that each program is up there as a podcast. You can listen to it. You can download it. You can do with it whatever you would do with a podcast. So that's WTIC.com. And then across the top, click on Heard on WTIC and go to the bottom for the Saturday stuff. And there we are. Now, let's get to the substance of what Mike is asking about, okay? The state legislature passed a law a few years ago to try to address this issue of boats that are either abandoned, missing, or something else. And what they did was to come up with a pretty comprehensive scheme. So we're going to explain a little bit about this, and then we're going to apply it to the circumstances of Mike's case as he's described it, okay? First of all, this has to do with boats that show up or are on someone else's property, boats that are on a mooring for more than 60 days without being paid, boats that are in a boatyard for more than a year since the last full payment, okay? Now, there's a lot of people out there that have boatyards, and they're probably familiar with this, and some of the smaller ones, maybe their ears perked up, they're going to be able to deal with this. Well, what happens, first of all, is that here's what the law says, okay? There's a presumption the boat is abandoned if this happens, okay? If it's left on the waters of the state, and that's all the places I mentioned, lakes, rivers, streams, ponds, or Long Island Sound, without the consent of the owner of any of the property, and if it's left on the water for more than 24 hours, that's deemed abandoned. If it's left on someone else's property, okay, then except when it's a tenant, then that's presumed to be abandoned after 90 days. So, Mike, we're going to come back to that because that applies exactly to your situation where your former tenant took off, left his boat behind, and you want to get rid of it. So we're going to come back to that. That is the basis for a presumption he's abandoned it if it's been there 90 days after the tenant left. And that applies if you evict him also. It's the termination of the occupancy. Similarly, if you leave it at a storage facility, boatyard, repair shop, and it's more than 1 year since the last full payment, okay? Now, if the boat is floating around loose, then for more than 24 hours, it's deemed abandoned if they find out it's not properly registered. So those folks out there that figure you're not going to pay the registration and we're just not going to have stickers on there, well, somebody finds that boat and turns it over to the authorities, you're not properly registered. After 24 hours, it's deemed abandoned. So let's get a little more specific now. Let's take Mike's situation. He is the landlord. The tenant is now gone. The boat is there, and it's probably not easy to move because the larger ones are not. What can he do? Well, first of all, it has to stay there for the period of time mentioned in the statute, so it's 90 days. Now, the 90 days pass, that boat is still there. You cannot touch it in the meantime, Mike, because it's still his property. You can move it off and store it somewhere else if you don't damage it, but that's a little bit different issue. The 90 days pass, you can seek the full cost of recovery from the owner of the boat for the following, for unpaid expense incurred as a result of the vessel abandonment. And we're going to come back to that later after we describe this process, okay? So the boat's been abandoned there because he's gone for 90 days. So here's what you have to do. You have to contact the commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. And they got a form, and you got to fill in the form, and you have to send it in with $20. And that starts this process, okay? The first thing that they're going to do is they're going to check and see if it's been reported as either stolen or missing. They're going to do that for any boat that somebody has started the process to see if it's been abandoned. The next thing they're going to do, get this, they're going to post information online on a publicly accessible abandoned vessel internet website, okay? The commissioner's also got to send a certified letter to the person who abandoned the vessel, providing that we know who that is. And then after all this happens and there's no response, this is what they're going to send to you, Mike. They're going to send you a water-resistant adhesive label, okay? Because you're now the person who has standing to start this process. And that label is going to tell whoever looks at that boat that it's being processed for abandonment. Now, you got to wait another 45 days, okay? And if the owner contacts the Commissioner of Environmental Energy and Environmental Protection, or you, well, then you deal with the issue of payment or, in your case, in removal. Nothing happens for the 45 days. The commissioner issues what's called a notice of assumed ownership. Okay, now you can sell the boat. But you asked us about applying the proceeds to back rent that this tenant owes you. Well, the statute doesn't specifically say that. What it does say is that it can be applied to the unpaid expense that was incurred as a result of or incidental to the vessel abandonment. So if you got expenses that you incurred in connection with that, that can probably, the proceeds from the sale, that can probably be used for that. But keeping it and applying it to several months of unpaid rent for the place that he lived might be a more difficult situation, okay? So, Mike, that is the story, and I hope that makes it a little more clear. Now, if we have a minute, I'm going to tell you a story about a recent court case that actually interpreted this. And this is a situation that sort of cried out for some justice. Okay, so we have Mr. Aguiar, and he kept his boat at a boatyard in Old Saybrook for ever since 2003. This boat of his is a 44-foot Carver motor yacht, and the boatyard had appraised it at $112,000. But apparently, he'd had a history of slow pays and partial pays and everything else. So this law goes into effect, and the boatyard says, well, we've had enough of this. We're going to declare it abandoned. So they go through this process, and he does get notice, and Aguiar gets notice, and he contacts the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and he says, hey, it's not abandoned. I'm just trying to make the payments. And so he also runs into somebody at the boatyard that works there, and they say, hey, as long as you're making partial payments, don't worry about it. He tries to make a partial payment. They turn it down. Then they get it declared abandoned. They sell it to one of the co-owners of the boatyard for $80,000. He turns around and immediately sells it to a friend for $90,000. Okay? It's a $112,000 boat, and Mr. Aguiar is stuck. Anyway, Mr. Aguiar sued. The long and the short of it is the court straightened it out, and the boatyard now owes him $95,000. So that is the end of that story. And the music that you hear in the background means that this is the end of yet another Law Talk. So it's time for me to say thanks to those of you that have called and allowed us to help you out on the air, because by doing so, you've allowed us to help others also. Thanks to you that have been listening, because you're the reason that we do this program. Time to say thanks to Mike Oko, my engineer, my producer, my friend who keeps me on the straight and narrow here, and who has the unenviable task of trying to make us sound good. As we say, see you next week. And that is exactly the case. So stay good, and next Saturday, it's you and me.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.